glad to have another opportunity to worship the one true and living God. I want to continue our study of Bible authority this morning. It's been a couple of weeks since we had a lesson on that. We had been talking about benevolence. We need to realize that the New Testament teaches that there are two realms of benevolent responsibility. We've been up to this time considering the benevolent responsibilities of the local church. Just as a point of review, very briefly, there's a pattern in the New Testament insofar as the local church is concerned with its benevolent responsibilities. We just observed part of that pattern as we took up a collection. On the first day of every week, Paul instructed the brethren at Corinth to do that. There's many other instructions insofar as the collection is concerned, as far as our attitudes as individuals in our giving. We're to be cheerful givers. We're to give as we've been prospered. We're to give abundantly and various and other sundry things in that regard. There's a pattern in the New Testament for the objects of church benevolence. Who is to receive benevolence? We have three examples in the New Testament where the church took care of needy people. And in all three of those examples, the objects of benevolence were needy saints, needy Christians. The church does not have a responsibility at all to the world in general when it comes to those in need. For example, the church in Jerusalem in the very beginning took care of its own needy. The church at Antioch, some 10 to 15 years later, sent aid to the brethren in Judea, which would have been south of Antioch in Syria, because there was a great famine that was prophesied in Acts chapter 11. Then another 10 or 15 years later, several churches, the churches of Macedonia, Galatia, the church at Corinth, that's what is discussed in 1 Corinthians 16, also in Romans 15, sent aid to needy saints in Jerusalem as another need arose. So that's what we had been studying insofar as the pattern. There's a pattern when it comes to the collection of the money. There's a pattern when it comes to the objects of benevolence. And then there's a pattern when it comes to how those funds are distributed to needy saints. For example, in the Jerusalem case, the very beginning of the church, it was distributed, for example, through members of the church. The deacons were appointed in Acts chapter 6 to make sure that the needs of the Grecian widows were taken care of. So I'm going to have some diagrams here to help us with this. This was not the pattern in Acts 2 or Acts 4 or Acts 6. There was no intervening entity, such as a benevolent society of some sort that the brethren had put together that was separate and apart from the church. There was no sponsoring church arrangement where funds were sent to a centralized church and then it distributed the funds. The benevolence was given directly from the apostles to the deacons and then those who were in need. So that's the Jerusalem relief in the beginning of the church. Then our second example is the Judean relief that's spoken of in Acts 11. The disciples at Antioch in Acts chapter 11, that is the local church at Antioch, sent funds to the elders of the churches of Judea through Barnabas and Saul. Very importantly, these funds were delivered directly to the elders among the brethren in Judea. We know in Acts 14 and verse 24 that elders were appointed in every church and that their oversight was limited to the church that had appointed them elders. So when these funds were sent to the brethren dwelling in Judea, the conclusion, and I think it's a necessary one, was that there were several congregations in Judea that were in need. And the funds were sent directly to the elders of those various congregations, and then they saw to it that those in need received the help that they were in need of. Very importantly, they did not set up this intervening kind of an organization where churches sent funds to some sort of organization that had a board of directors, and then that organization dispersed the funds. Neither did they send the funds to one church and allow that church to make the decisions insofar as dispersing the funds to other congregations. So this was not the pattern. Again, there was no intervening organization like a benevolent society, nor was there an intervening, what we would call, sponsoring church that was overseeing all of this work. It went directly to the congregations that had needy saints. So this was the pattern. Barnabas and Saul took those funds from the church at Antioch and gave it to the churches that had needs. And then the elders of those churches made sure that the needy saints among them were taken care of. So that's the second example. Then the third and final example is the distribution of funds that took place in Jerusalem later, some 20 years after the first need in the beginning. In 1 Corinthians 16 and other passages in 2 Corinthians, Paul was going to bring those funds unto the Jerusalem, the collection for the saints. It wasn't for everyone, but it was for the saints. So again, there was no sponsoring church involved in this, nor was there any benevolent society, but the funds were sent directly from these churches of Galatia and so forth through Paul and other messengers directly to the church at Jerusalem. So that's a very important point for us to remember. So very briefly, I want to summarize the pattern for church benevolence. First of all, there's a pattern insofar as purpose is concerned. The funds were to fulfill the necessities of life. A true need existed among the saints in the church that received the funds. There was some sort of emergency that arose before other churches were engaged in assisting in taking care of those needs. What I'm trying to get at is that churches did not create some sort of a need and then beg other churches for money. The needs, furthermore, were always temporary in nature, and the benevolence was sent only until the need was relieved. Remember, 2 years ago, the terrible typhoon hit the Philippines, and thousands of people were killed, and hundreds of brethren were affected. There was a great deal of money raised from churches and from individual Christians. I think something over $200,000, which was amazing. But when the need was taken care of, they quit collecting the funds. There's a pattern insofar as the manner of collection. It was done on every first day of the week, where individual saints, members of the congregation, gave. And Mark pointed that out this morning. We don't solicit funds from non-members. We don't raise funds by bake sales and bingo games, car washes. In Wisconsin, there were even Catholic churches that had beer tents to raise money. There was one local Catholic church that every summer raffled off a new Buick. We don't raise funds in that way. First Furthermore, funds were not collected any other time than the first day of the week as we gathered together to worship. Also, in the first century, Christians did not tithe, nor was the amount they gave based on some sort of a man-made formula. When I lived in Michigan, I was shocked. One of my colleagues that I worked with was a member of the Methodist Church, and we got to talking about church and so forth, and he told me, which I was totally shocked, that the Methodist Church that he was a member of, they had to report their annual income, and then the church told them how much they were expected to give. Well, that's not according to the New Testament pattern. Then the New Testament pattern, insofar as the subject, again, from the local church treasury, only needy saints were helped. The church was never designed to be a Red Cross society, a community food bank, etc., for the general public. In Acts chapter 11, for example, there was a great famine throughout the whole world, but where was the money sent? And who was it sent to? It was sent to relieve the needy brethren dwelling in Judea. Some people, some members of the church, argue that benevolence is an aid to evangelism. And I've heard this said many times. After all, people won't care how much we know until they know how much we care. Well, there's a certain truth to that, but we don't justify breaking the New Testament pattern through some sort of human philosophy. Furthermore, I've had people use John chapter 6 when Jesus fed the 5,000 try to justify this. In actuality, John chapter 6 teaches the very opposite of that. Benevolence is not an aid to evangelism. You might want to turn over to John chapter 6. I want to read a few verses to prove that point. You remember Jesus fed the 5,000 and they followed him. They were interested. They were hooked, you might want to say. But notice what Jesus says to them in verse 26. He says, "Most assuredly I say to you, you seek me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because the Father has set his seal on him." And he didn't feed them no more. And what happened? They quit following him. In verse 66, "From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more." So when the food stopped, many quit following. Human wisdom is not our source of authority. There's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death, the wise man said. There's a great deal of emotionalism attached to this argument that we have to extend benevolence in order to evangelize. And we must not fall into the trap of that emotionalism. What is God's calling card to man? It's the gospel. The power of God unto salvation is in the gospel. Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17. The Thessalonians, they were called by God. How? Through the gospel. If the church uses food or fun or frolic, whatever it might be, to call men to salvation, they've used a false calling card. And in order to keep people, you're going to have to keep giving them food, fun, and frolic. Otherwise, people are going to leave, just like they did in the days of Jesus in John chapter 6. So the local church cannot scripturally aid non-believers from its treasury, but that does not mean, and this is very important, that we as individual Christians do not have responsibilities when it comes to non-Christians. We do have a responsibility, and we're going to talk more on that in a moment. Furthermore, there was a pattern according to the distribution. No local church both received and sent funds. Funds were sent directly to the elders of the local church where the needy saints were located. And those elders made sure that the aid got into the hands of those who needed it. Again, there was no intervening benevolent society, no intervening sponsoring church. This is extremely important. A failure by the local congregation to follow the New Testament pattern in benevolence has the same ramifications and consequences as not following the New Testament pattern in other areas. We're to partake of the fruit of the vine and the unleavened bread. We have no right to substitute Coca-Cola and Twinkies on the Lord's table. And we have no authority to circumvent the pattern of benevolence in the New Testament. Well, let's move on to the benevolent responsibility of individual Christians. This is extremely important because I think there are many Christians that forget that once we put our funds in the plate on Sunday morning, does not mean that our responsibility in benevolence is finished. It's taken care of. We have very important individual responsibilities. Unfortunately, we live in a very materialistic society, and materialism becomes a great impediment for us to properly discharge these individual benevolent responsibilities. If we're not careful, we become influenced by the materialism that's so rampant in the world. I never considered this until maybe 10 years ago, and it dawned on me when I was preparing a sermon on benevolence. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. What is one of the important reasons the Lord expects us to work, to make a living? Well, Ephesians 4:28 tells us. Paul says, let him who stole steal no longer, so that keeps us from being a thief, but rather let him labor, working with his good. Now notice this, that he may have something to give him who has need. We're not only to take care of ourselves and our family, but if we're able, we need to help those who are in need. Unfortunately, again, the materialism in our society tempts us sometimes to overspend on things that we really don't need. And I can guarantee you, the older I get, the more I realize that when I was younger, there were a lot of things that I thought I needed that I really didn't need. That became painfully aware when we moved from Michigan to Indiana. There was a whole bunch of junk that we had to move that I'm like, what in the world was I thinking when I bought that thing? I really didn't need it. So it's easy for us to be consumed with what I would call the bigger barn syndrome. You remember in Luke chapter 12, the man had a bumper crop and he tore down his barns and built bigger barns. But God said to him, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you. And so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. So we need to not only give as we've prospered here, but we need to be willing to share with others. Unfortunately, I think there's some folks, and I'm not accusing anybody here of that by any means, but some people are just downright stingy. They don't want to share. Then on the other side of the coin, there are some people that are objects of benevolence that have unrealistic expectations. Benevolence is meant to take care of needs, not wants. I had this vividly demonstrated to me one time in Michigan. A lady called me out of the blue. I didn't know her from Adam's house cat. And she was complaining to me. Washer and dryer had quit. And she wanted the church, she wasn't a member of our church, I'd never heard of her before, to buy her a washer and dryer. And when I said, well, we don't do that sort of thing. Well, I was the worst person that had ever been born on the face of the earth by turning her down for that. Well, let's talk about the scope of individual responsibility. In Hebrews 13 and verse 16, the Hebrew writer said that we're not to forget to do good and to what? To share. For with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. In Romans 12 and verse 13, you remember Romans 12 is what I call a bullet point chapter. There's all these bullet point things that we're expected to do as individual saints. And one of them is to distribute to the needs of the saints and to be given to hospitality. Turn over to James chapter 2. In James chapter 2, of course, that's the great chapter on having a working faith. But notice the lead up to that in verse 14. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? Now he's going to give an example. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them things that are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul issues a warning to those that are rich. And I have to admit, until 2010, I thought this applied to somebody else and never applied to me. But when I went to the Philippines, I realized that it applied to me. And it applies to most of us in this audience. Because compared to folks like that, we indeed are rich. Command those who are rich, verse 17, in this present age, not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them, that's the rich, do good, that they may be rich in good works. Now notice, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. We indeed are rich compared to many people in this world. There's three fellows that I know. The man on the beyond your left there is Robinson Pulveris. He's a preacher in the Philippines, and Sherry and I have had the good fortune to be able to help support him since 2003. His fellow workers are two men there, Alfredo Camagay and Danilo Bautista. Danilo is of the Negritos tribe, which are the poorest of the poor in the Philippines. Neither of those two preachers have anybody helping support them. But they do good work. They go up into the mountains. They not only preach in their local congregations, but they go up in the mountains and work with these Negritos people. When I went to the Philippines, I got a chance to preach at the congregation where Robinson preaches. And I've told this story before, but a year or two before I went, there had been a bad storm and the saints there were in need, and Sherry and I sent a bit of money over there. It wasn't a great amount by any means, and I had totally forgotten about it. But nearly every member of that congregation remembered that I had sent funds and came up and thanked me. It was really when Acts chapter 20 and verse 35 really came home to me that it indeed is more blessed to give than it is to receive. This is one of the Negritos villages in where Robinson preaches, and you can see that those people are desperately poor. Some of them even don't have living conditions this good. I would say those are, with those thatched roof huts, are probably the more well-to-do among the Negritos people. With that in mind, let's turn over to Matthew 25 and read an extended reading that I think really gets at the heart of our individual responsibility when it comes to benevolence. Brethren, we're going to be judged on how we've discharged that responsibility. Beginning in verse 31, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Why is that the case? For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, you might notice the picture up here, one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Then he will also say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous unto eternal life. There are so many people in need. And it doesn't take a great deal of money to help these people. Here's another case. This little boy, Junrei, has leukemia. And the medicine, he's got to take this medicine for like 2 years, and it costs some exorbitant amount, like $15,000 or $16,000 a year. But some good brethren that I know took up his cause and solicited money from saints, and they've raised to date about $30,000 to help this boy. And all they asked was people to donate, I think it was $89. I don't know how they came up with $89, but so Sherry and I donated $89, but there were enough people donating $89, which most people can afford, that there's plenty of funds to take care of this need. Here's another one. The gentleman at the back, his name Elpidio Tiene. He's a Negritos preacher. This is his family, and unfortunately, this is his little daughter that passed away. He has no support. Even $50 a month would tremendously help a person like this, or the other two preachers that I showed. Even though these brethren are 8,000 miles away, we can't ignore needs like this. We can't close our eyes, because then we become just like in the story of the Good Samaritans, the ones that pass by on the other side. So I'd encourage you, if you could help them regularly, help them one time. There are plenty of needs, and it's not only in the Philippines. There's needs in Africa, India, all over the world. We'll never run out of needs. Unfortunately, I get requests every week that I have to turn down, because I just can't afford to take care of everybody. Well, let's move on. One thing that's becomes quite controversial, especially among brethren, is the confusion between individual versus responsibilities. That's why I had the reading this morning from 1 Timothy chapter 5. Simply for the fact that this passage makes it perfectly clear. It doesn't completely define the differences, but it shows there is a difference between the responsibilities of us as individual Christians versus the responsibilities of the church. One of Paul's points in that passage is we need to take care of our individual responsibilities that the church not be charged. There's a difference. Well, some counter by saying, well, whatever the church is doing, the individual's doing. That's just not true. This very passage says there's a difference. And we need fully explore that to find out what our individual responsibilities are versus the responsibilities of the church, and not confuse the two and make sure that we're taking care of our responsibilities and the church is doing the work that God has given it. I would point to James 1 and verse 27 as an important verse in this regard. James writes, "Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." This passage unequivocally shows that we have a responsibility as individuals to keep ourselves unspotted from the world, correct? Well, we also have the responsibility, according to this, as individuals to visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction. I'm not going to take the time to go through it, but starting back in verse 12 of this chapter, there are more than a dozen times that the writer identifies individual responsibilities, and it comes to a crescendo here in verse 27. We have a responsibility towards the fatherless and the widows as individual Christians. I might back up and tell a little story about that that drove me crazy. That was one of the problems with the church in Grayling, Michigan. They thought they were really taking care of the orphans. There was an orphanage in Ohio, which is not really an orphanage because I investigated. There are no orphans there. There are troubled children there, but they all have families. So first of all, they're not orphans, so they don't meet James 1 and verse 27. But anyway, this congregation was sending them jars of mustard and pancake mix. And that was taking care of the orphans. I don't think that's what James 1 and verse 27 is about. Well, moving on. The story of the Good Samaritan. So which of the men do you think was his neighbor? And it was the one who showed mercy to him, one that extended benevolence to him. So we have a responsibility towards the world in general as individual Christians. Paul brings this out in Galatians 6 and verse 10. "Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all, especially unto those who are of the household of faith." Now, I very quickly want to add that our individual benevolent responsibility depends on three things. First of all, we have to have compassion for others. We have to have opportunity, and we have the means. There's plenty of opportunity. Maybe not all of us have the means, so I don't want people to go away that we all have to do this. Some of us may not have the ability to do that. We might be those in need ourselves. Obviously, the Negritos in the Philippines don't have the means to help others. Also, as we read from Matthew 25, we're going to be judged as individuals based on our success or failure to discharge these individual benevolent responsibilities. Okay, Galatians 6 and verse 10. Some brethren try to teach that this passage is talking about the responsibility of the local church and not the individual Christian. So I want to examine that. There's two arguments that are often given. They say, well, the letter is addressed in verse 2 of chapter 1 to the churches of Galatia. So Galatians 6 and verse 10 is talking about the congregational responsibility, not individual responsibility. Well, that's a false argument. For example, the letter to the 1 Corinthians is addressed to the church of God, which is at Corinth. So does that mean that everything discussed in there is talking about the responsibility of the congregation as a whole? No, it's not. It talks about many things that are applicable only to individuals. For example, in chapter 7, it talks about the marriage relationship and the sexual relationship between a husband and his wife. In chapters 8 through 10, it talks about the eating of meats, and that's an individual matter. In chapter 6, it talks about going to law with a brother, and that, again, is an individual matter, and we could go on and on. Well, similarly, the letter to the Galatians is addressed to the churches of Galatia, but it has a lot to say about individual responsibilities. For example, in chapter 5, developing the fruit of the Spirit is an individual responsibility, and avoiding the works of the flesh is an individual responsibility. The laws of sowing and reaping, just prior to Galatians 6 and verse 10, apply to our actions as an individual. So my contention is this argument is merely a smokescreen to shift the individual Christian's responsibility onto the church, and then to justify the church's support of various institutions. In the New Testament, instructions are often given collectively and only applicable personally. Okay, argument number 2. Galatians 6 and verse 10 uses the plural pronouns we and us. Therefore, the passage refers to congregational responsibility, not individual responsibility. It's basically the argument that I'm a he, I'm not a we. Well, when we use plural pronouns, we're including individuals, aren't we? Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good unto all. Well, I would just refer these folks to Galatians 5 and verse 25. It uses the same pronouns, we and us. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. That's addressed to individuals, isn't it? It encompasses all individual Christians, but we carry that out as individuals. Walking in the Spirit is the lifestyle of each individual Christians. Very importantly, for us to fail in our duty in regards to our personal responsibilities when it comes to benevolence, is going to cause us to be lost. That's the point of Matthew chapter 25, which we read. We're going to be judged by God. At least one of the criteria is going to be how we've taken care of that responsibility. When I study the errors of our liberal brethren when it comes to mixing individual and church responsibility in regards to benevolence, one of the things that I see is the greatest danger. If we say that the church has a responsibility of general benevolence, that takes away my responsibility as an individual Christian in that regard. Because from the three passages we've read, the church doesn't have a responsibility in that regard. So what I'm saying is that when you teach the error on this, what it fools Christians into believing is when that plate has been passed and I put my money in there, I've taken care of my individual responsibility. I haven't. That individual responsibility is still there. In giving of my means on the first day of the week, I've done a good thing. I've done something that I'm supposed to do. But I've not met the requirements of Matthew 25 or Galatians 6 and verse 10. And just like the church has to follow the pattern, we as individuals have to follow the pattern when it comes to benevolence. We can't turn over our individual responsibilities to the church in that regard, just as we can't turn over our responsibilities as a father or a husband or a wife or a son or a daughter, or to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So let us, God's word is the only source of our religious authority. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Whatever we do in word or deed must be done according to the authority of Christ. We must not appeal to emotion, but appeal to Scripture. The Lord has given the church a very simple but profound and important program of work: evangelizing, preaching the gospel, building one another up through edification, and the church has a responsibility to needy saints when it comes to evangelism. Then there's a clear distinction between individual and church responsibility, and we must follow the pattern on that. And we can no more disregard that pattern than disregard the pattern for the work of the church, the worship, the plan of salvation, whatever it might be. Unfortunately, most of the denominations that I know of violate that pattern, and so do many that claim to be a church of Christ. Also, some use emotionalism. They use emotionalism to demean and denigrate those that do follow the pattern. That was certainly the case that happened in Michigan last fall, when it was taught, the truth was taught, these people made all kinds of accusations. Oh, you people are just orphan haters. Nothing further from the truth. What's taking care of your responsibility in that regard? Sending some mustard and pancake mix? Or actually taking an orphan into your home? So we must follow God's word and not violate the New Testament pattern, especially when it comes to benevolence. When we turn the church into a general benevolence organization, we're detracting from the primary mission of the church, and that's to preach the gospel. Certainly, people need their physical needs taken care of, but more importantly, they need their spiritual needs taken care of. And that's exactly why Jesus did the miracle in John 6, to prove that he had the credentials to give them the proper spiritual message. And when he made it clear that he would no longer meet their physical needs, then unfortunately many left. So some people counter with this. Well, how will the work get done if the church doesn't do it? And my answer to that is very simple. When we talk about the general needs of the world, it gets done when every Christian takes care of his individual responsibility. I can't help everyone. You can't help everyone. But most of us can help somebody. And that's how the work gets done. That's the purpose that we're to work, at least one of the purposes, to have something to help those that are in need. So remember, 1 Timothy 6 applies to almost everybody in this audience. We indeed are rich compared to others, and we need to be willing to share with those in need. Then very importantly, as individual Christians, as local churches, let's each take care of our responsibility as it's talked about in Scripture and not mix those two together. With that in mind, one of my favorite passages, because it's such a profound passage: whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, does the love of God abide in him? How can we see these needs and not want to do something? If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, we want to encourage you to become one. With that in mind, if you're subject to the invitation, we bid you come while we stand and sing.